Hello, I'm Peter Donat. In this program of Transformations of Myth Through Time, Joseph Campbell brings us to an exploration of the mythology of ancient Egypt. To most of us, Egypt still means the Sphinx, the pyramids, monuments along the thin ribbon of land bordering the Nile. To some, the tombs of ancient pharaohs speak only of the futile attempts of powerful monarchs to achieve immortality, mummified and buried among precious possessions in a vain attempt to disprove the adage, you can't take it with you. Campbell proves that to think this way not only insults the mythic heritage of a complex and sophisticated civilization, but robs us of the opportunity to derive meaning from the symbolic stories that undergird its mythology. In recounting the myth of Osiris, perhaps the most important and popular in Egyptian culture, Campbell uncovers the themes of death and resurrection, which seem uncommonly familiar.
And now we come to the next, this is the next part of our story. The invasions of the Indo-Europeans. These invasions come from the areas north of the Black Sea and stretching along that great grazing area, where we had races, biologically plural races, speaking related languages. The Indo-European languages were first recognized as one family in the 18th century, about 1782 or 3, by Sir William Jones, who was the first Westerner, really, to make a study of Sanskrit. He was a judge in the court of Calcutta. And he recognized that the Sanskrit, the language of India, was related very closely to Latin, Greek, the Germanic and Celtic languages. This is one family of languages with an enormous spread. And they are carried by these herding people, nomadic herding people, who mastered the horse and then the war chariot. This indicates their area. The differentiated Indo-European groups are Aryans. The word Aryan is a Sanskrit word meaning noble. In the Caucasus Mountains here, bronze first appears in this part of the world about 4000 BC. It is picked up by the Indo-Europeans, and the Indo-European bronze spear point becomes the token, the key to their distribution. It appears over an enormous range. The people that we have been talking about up to the time of these invasions were relatively peaceful people. But now comes the Indo-European warrior people, and the whole world is transformed, you might say, into fighting tribal groups. At the same time, from the Syro-Arabian desert are coming the Semites with the same essential warrior-like accent. And the principal deities of warriors are male deities, thunder hurlers, as Yahweh and Zeus. Now, saying that, I want to come to another point. Yahweh and Zeus. In most of these mythologies of the Indo-Europeans, the principal deities are those of the universal order, the ones that I've been talking about. Secondary deities are the local tribal patrons, for instance, Indra. They pray to Indra for victory in war. But Indra is secondary to the great cosmic, as I showed yesterday, the humbling of Indra. However, among the Semites, the tribal deity is top deity. So if you are in the Indo-European context, you could say, he whom we call Zeus, you call Indra. This is known as syncretism. A syncretic tendency pervades. When Alexander the Great went into India in the 3rd century BC, he and his young officers recognized the same gods that they were themselves worshipping. And they made correlations. Krishna was identified with Heracles, Indra with Zeus, and so forth and so on. When Caesar, 3 centuries later, went into Gaul, you can read it in book 6 of Caesar's Gallic Wars. He describes the Celtic religion in terms of Roman god names. So we don't always know what god he's talking about. He's talking about Apollo, Mercury, and so forth. This is syncretism. But when you get to the Semitic tribes, you cannot say, he whom you call Eshur, we call Yahweh. Try to say that and get away with it. Here you have an exclusivism and a tribalism, which in Judaism continues to this day. Not only that, but Yahweh is the only God. The others are devils. There's no God in all the earth but in Israel. This is the religion that we've inherited in our Western tradition. I had a really very moving experience listening to Martin Buber one time back in 1955. He was in New York, lecturing to a small group, a group about this size. For some reason or other, I'd been invited. I can't imagine why. But he was a wonderfully eloquent speaker, and when you realize that English was not his first language, it was quite a remarkable performance. But I didn't know what he meant by God. I didn't know whether he was using the word a good deal. I didn't know whether he was referring to the mystery behind all these galaxies or to some stage or other of the primitive biblical deity who is transformed from one century to another in his character. Also, he paused at one moment to say, it pains me to speak of God in the third person. When I told this to Gershom Scholem, he said, well, sometimes he does go too far. But so I raised my hand and I said, Dr. Buber, there's a word being used here today that I do not understand. He said, what is that word? I said, God. You can imagine, you don't know what God means. I said, I don't know what you mean by God. You're telling us God has hidden his face. Nobody sees him today. I've just come from India, where people are experiencing the face of God all the time. So what does he say? Do you mean to compare? That finished that for me. It was even so outrageous that the MC cut in. He said, no, Dr. Mr. Campbell just wants to know what you mean. So he said, well, we all have to come out of our exile in our own way. But the Indians aren't in exile because the God's right in here. These are the differences that have to be recognized when you're talking cross-culturally about religions in terms of comparative religions. Compare, yes, I do compare. It's my job. Those are different ideas. So what we have here is a tendency towards syncretism, accent on the universal deities, with then tribal deities who are the local patrons but belong to the larger system. You don't have different systems in different places. You have one great system with local ancestral patrons. Here we are in Mycenae, 1500, the chariot. Now, before the invention of the horse collar, which rests on the horse's shoulders, and so the weight is pulled from the horse's shoulders, the vehicles were drawn by a band across the horse's chest. And the horse's windpipe is out front, so that if you have a heavy vehicle, he's choked. And they could not invent a really usable war chariot, a flexible one, until they had mastered a race of very powerful horses. And as you see, very light chariots were used. The invention took place around 1800 BC in those differentiated Indo-European plains culture spheres. Here we are in Mycenae, in the Peloponnese of Greece. Here is the death mask of one of those master warriors from Mycenae. This is from the great Mycenae Acropolis. Here is a burial, together with the chariot and the two horses that drew it. And now we go to China. Same date, there's a burial. Two horses, the chariot, and the charioteer buried along with it. And here's the mask of one of those warriors. A different race, same culture. This is Shang period, China, around 1600 or so BC. Here, from India, this is a page from the Mahabharata, the great chariot warriors of India. Tutankhamun, the same chariot. Tutankhamun's about 1340 or something like that, BC. But you can see it's the same tradition. This is what's known as diffusion. From a creative center, a new idea goes out, and with it go the deities and energy symbols in association with it. We move now to Egypt. The Nile. Egyptian history is quite easy to follow because the earliest periods it's in Lower Egypt, the middle period it's in Middle Egypt, and the final period it's in Upper Egypt. Here we enter the area around 4000 BC. This is from a tomb at Hierakonpolis, a tomb with two chambers. Suggests Sati again. This is an early mural on that tomb. There's nothing Egyptian about it in its qualities. It looks much more like something from Iran, such as we might have seen. And I'll show you some of the details. There we have the interlocked animals, such as we saw in the Samarra, 4000 BC. But this is about 500 years later. So the influences are coming in from the Mesopotamian area and inspiring a development in Egypt. Here is the figure dumping animals again. Here are the figures going around the center. All motifs from Iran. And then suddenly, around 3200 BC, first, second dynasties, we have the arrival and development of a specifically and indubitably Egyptian art form, which remains then for 3,000 years. The sudden appearance. There it is. That's Egypt. This is called Namr's palette. And it is King Namr of Upper Egypt wearing the crown of Upper Egypt, subduing the pharaoh, or whatever one would call him, of the delta. Here is his totem animal, the hawk, with the king of the delta, or the delta, by the nose. This is the papyrus swamps of the delta. Here are the enemy slain. This figure up here, this cow figure, is Hathor, the goddess of the horizon. And she appears, and you'll see when I reverse this, in four aspects here. The king is wearing a belt. He's wearing a bull's tail. He is the moon bull incarnate. The pharaoh is the highest god. He is Osiris, the moon bull incarnate. And on his belt are the face forms of Hathor in front, in back, and on either side. The pharaoh fills the horizon. This is the other side. Here's Hathor again. Here is the king now wearing the crown of Lower Egypt, of the delta. These are the symbols of his pharaonic power. These are the dead of the delta's armies. And here are the animals symbolic of Upper and Lower Egypt forming one great state. From here on, Egypt is the two lands, Upper and Lower Egypt, and the pharaoh undergoes two installations on the throne, two coronations, one with the crown of Upper, the other with the crown of Lower Egypt. And here we have the two incarnations of the king, the crown of Upper and the crown of Lower Egypt, which then become combined. Now we come to the first of the great pyramids. This is the step pyramid of King Djoser, 2600 BC. And this is built by the great architect Imhotep. One can visit this great compound today, and it's a beautiful experience, really. All the temple architecture and all of the motifs of later architecture in Egypt are stated here. 2600 BC, suddenly they come to form. The earlier graves were covered by earth mounds, which have washed away with time. But here now we have the first of the pyramids. Now what the Sphinx represents is the power of pharaonic rule. Every king is, as it were, an incarnation of this power. The Sphinx is the son of the lion goddess Sekhmet by a strange moon-like god called Ptah, who's usually represented as a mummy. But a moonbeam impregnated the goddess, and she gave birth to the Sphinx. Now we come to the middle period. The pharaoh is the incarnation of Osiris, and he is protected by the sun hawk Horus, who is the son of Osiris. Early dynasties. Then there comes what's called the first intermediary period, when for a number of dynasties there was nothing but upheaval and destruction. Then the Middle Kingdom comes again, and finally that is wiped out by an invasion from Asia, known as the invasion of the Hyksos. One theory for the entry of the Jews into Egypt is that they came in at the time of the Hyksos. This is just shortly following the time of Hammurabi, which I've just spoken about. If that were so, however, they would not have been there in the time of Ramses, because the Hyksos were thrown out at the time of the founding of the New Kingdom. These are the great dynasties of which we mostly read. And now I want to give the basic myth of Osiris and Isis and so forth. This is the heaven goddess Nut, just the opposite to the way it is in Mesopotamia, where the god is above and the goddess is the earth. Here we have the heaven goddess Nut spangled with stars, and here is her consort Heb, the earth god. This is the lord of the cosmic abyss out of which all has come. Riding on the sky boat, the great boat of Re, the god of the sun, the souls that are in this barge course over the sky, and instead of descending like this, they enter the mouth of Nut and then are born in the east. This is the west where they set, and here is the east where the barge emerges. Here is the lord of air who separates heaven and earth. These are basic mythic motifs that will occur in many other mythologies. Now, the children of Heb and Nut are first Isis and Osiris. This is the goddess Isis. She is the throne on which the pharaoh sits. She is the throne. Here is Osiris, her twin brother. They are husband and wife. This is Nephthys, who is the wife of Set, who is the other brother, the younger brother and sister, Set and Nephthys. Now, in a famous night, Osiris slept with Nephthys, thinking she was Isis. This is inattention to details, and from things of that kind, bad results can follow. She then bore a child who was known as Anubis, and he had the head of a jackal. But Set didn't like this, and he planned revenge. The revenge was to take perfect measurements of Osiris and to have a sarcophagus fashioned that would fit him exactly. And a jolly party was in full progress when Set comes in and says, "I have this beautiful sarcophagus, and anyone whom it fits can have it." So it's like Cinderella in the glass slipper. They all try the sarcophagus. And when Osiris is in it, it fits perfectly, and 72 attendants come rushing in, clap their lid on the sarcophagus, wrap iron bands around it, and throw it into the Nile. So there goes Osiris down the Nile. He's washed ashore in Syria, and a great tree grows around him and encloses the sarcophagus. Isis now starts out to find her husband. And, you know, she's a goddess, and somehow her intuition leads her. She comes to this place in Syria where Osiris is enclosed in the tree. Meanwhile, however, the prince of that little town has had a child. A little boy has been born, and the prince has built a palace. The wonderful aroma that comes from this tree has so entranced him that he has had the tree cut down and fashioned into a pillar in the palace. And so Osiris is in the palace in the form of a pillar. Well, Isis arrives, and she sits down by a well, and when the young women from the palace come out to draw water from the well, they invite this beautiful older woman in to become nurse for the child, for the newborn little prince. And she does accept the job. And she nurses the child from her little finger. I mean, goddesses can stoop only so far. Then at night, to give the child immortality, she places him in the fireplace and recites certain charms that the fire is supposed to burn off his mortal character and turn him into an immortal. Meanwhile, she turns into a swallow and, twittering mournfully, flies around the pillar. Well, one evening, the little boy's mother happens to break in on this scene, and you can imagine she let out a scream. There was her baby in the fireplace, and this nobody watching him, and just a funny twittering swallow flying around a post. And the child had to be rescued from the fire because the spell was broken, and the swallow turned into this beautiful nursemaid that they had hired, namely Isis. And Isis said, she explained the situation as well as she could. And then she said, "And by the way, my husband's in that pillar." So she said, "Could you please give me the pillar so I can take my husband home?" And the king, very polite, said, "Here you are, my darling." So there's Isis, you can tell by the throne on her head. And here's Osiris coming to her in the form of a pillar. He's put on the barge. And on the barge, on the way back to the papyrus swamp, she takes off the lid and lies closely upon the dead Osiris and conceives Horus. Now, Osiris has two sons, one by Nephthys, Anubis, the jackal boy, and another by Isis, Horus. She is afraid to go back to the palace because Set has assumed the throne. She goes into the papyrus swamp and gives birth to her son, Horus. Here she is in solitude giving birth. And the god Amun comes and Thoth come and assist her in the pain of the delivery. So there she is, and Set now chasing a boar. He's hunting a boar, follows this boar into the papyrus swamp, and my lord, there is Isis with Osiris's corpse beside her. In a rage, he tears Osiris into 15 pieces, scatters the 15 pieces over the landscape, and poor Isis has to go hunt for him again. So she is helped now by Nephthys, who joins her, and little Anubis, the little jackal boy who sniffs around, and they get 14 of the 15 pieces. The dead Osiris is associated with the rising of the Nile, which fertilizes Egypt, and the juices of his disintegrating body are identified with the waters of the Nile, and it is he, therefore, that is the fertilizing force of Egypt. The 14 pieces are put together, and here's the little boy Anubis in the role later assumed by the priests embalming, who reassembles the body and embalms it. The piece that was missing is the genital organs, which have been swallowed by a fish. And this is the background of the fish meal on Fridays. It's a sacramental consuming of the sacred flesh. Osiris, now no longer being a generator, is the image of the dead Pharaoh, and he becomes the lord of the underworld. The resurrected Osiris is now the judge of the dead in the underworld. His son, Horus, who has been born and rapidly grown up, has engaged in a great battle with his uncle Set to avenge his father. In that battle, Horus lost an eye, and this eye is symbolic of sacrificial offering. It was through the loss of that eye that he brought his father back to life. Set lost a testicle in the combat. So now we come to the judgment scene. This is a papyrus, the Book of the Dead of Ani. Here is Osiris seated by the waters of eternal life on the throne of the judge of the dead. Behind him are his two queens, Isis and Nephthys. He has the symbolic shepherd's crook and winnowing whip that winnows wheat, separating the chaff from the seed. Here is the eye of Horus by which he has been resurrected. Growing from the waters of eternal life is the lotus of the world, and these are the four sons of Horus who represent the four points of the compass of the universe. Now, when a person dies, he becomes identified with Osiris. This is a very important thing. The dead person is called Osiris. Osiris Jones, let's say. And he goes on the underworld journey to unite with Osiris. Osiris is going to Osiris. I and the Father are one, that motif. On the way, he eats back all the gods. This means the gods are understood to be projections of the energies of ourselves. Consuming the gods, in some cases it's represented actually as cannibalism. In other texts, he simply says, my head is the head of Anubis, my shoulders the shoulders of Set, or something like this. Every organ of my body is the organ of some god, and nobody will take my heart from me in the underworld. And then what you get some sense of the dangers of the underworld. Get you back, you crocodile of the north. Get you back, you crocodile of the south. Then he comes to the great moment of the opening of the mouth in the underworld. I am yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I have the power to be born a second time. I am that source from which the gods arise. This is a great realization, and this is what must be realized properly before you die, and finally, if not then, on the way into the underworld. Then we come, in the underworld, to the great weighing of the heart of the dead against a feather. If the heart is heavier than the feather, this monster will consume the man. If the feather is heavier than the heart, or of the same balance, then the person is eligible for spiritual life. Here is Ani, a certain scribe for whom this papyrus was prepared, being conducted to the weighing. Here is Anubis doing the weighing. Here is the monster waiting to see if he can have a meal. Here is Thoth recording the results. And then, under the charge of Horus, Ani is led to the very throne of Osiris. This is the Book of the Dead, and the mythology is explicit.